What's the problem?
You mean the N-22? That's right. Well, this is a contentious issue, so I'd prefer to go off the record.
How far off?
Background?
Okay.
In the past, the Europeans accepted FAA certification of a new aircraft because that certification was thought to be very rigorous. But lately, JAA has been questioning the U.S. certification process. They feel that the American agency, the FAA, is in bed with the American manufacturers and may have relaxed its standards.
Really?
Perfect, Jennifer thought. Inept American bureaucracy. Dick Schenck loved those stories. And the FAA had been under attack for years. There must be plenty of skeletons there.
What's the evidence? She asked.
Well, the Europeans find the whole system unsatisfactory. For example, the FAA doesn't even store certification documents. They allow the aircraft companies to do that. It seems entirely too cozy.
Uh-huh, she wrote.
FAA in bed with manufacturers. Corrupt. Anyway, the woman said, if you want more information, I suggest you call the JAA directly or maybe Airbus. I can give you the numbers. She called the FAA instead. She got put through to their public affairs office, a man named Wilson. I understand the JAA is refusing to validate certification of the Norton N-22.
Yes, Wilson said. They've been dragging their feet for a while now.
The FAA has already certified the N-22?
Oh, sure. You can't build an airplane in this country without FAA approval and certification of the design and manufacturing process from start to finish.
And do you have the certification documents?
No, they're kept by the manufacturer. Norton has them.
Aha, she thought. So it was true. Norton keeps certification, not FAA. Box guarding chicken coop?
Does it bother you that Norton holds the documentation?
No, not at all.
And you're satisfied that the certification process was proper?
Oh, sure, and like I said, the plane was certified 5 years ago.
I've been hearing that the Europeans are dissatisfied with the entire process of certification.
Well, you know, Wilson said, adopting a diplomatic tone, the JAA's a relatively new organization. Unlike the FAA, they have no statutory authority, so I think they're still trying to decide how they want to proceed.
She called the information office for Airbus Industry in Washington and got put through to a marketing guy named Samuelson. He reluctantly confirmed that he had heard of the JAA confirmation delays, though he didn't have any details.
But Norton's having a lot of problems these days, he said. For example, I think the China sale is not as firm as they pretend it is.
This was the first she had heard of a China sale. She wrote, China sale, N-22, ? She said, uh-huh.
I mean, let's face it, Samuelson continued.
The Airbus A340 is a superior plane in every way. It's newer than the Norton widebody, better range.
It's better in every way. We've been trying to explain this to the Chinese, and they are starting to understand our perspective. Anyway, if I had to guess, I'd guess the Norton sale to the People's Republic is going to fall apart. And of course, safety concerns are part of that decision. Off the record, I think the Chinese are very concerned the plane is unsafe.
C thinks airplane unsafe. Who would I talk to about that? She said.
Well, as you know, the Chinese are generally reluctant to discuss negotiations in progress, Samuelson said. But I know a guy over at Commerce who may be able to help you. He's with the Ex-Im Bank, which provides long-term financing for overseas sales.
What's his name? She said.
His name was Robert Gordon. It took 15 minutes for the operator at the Commerce Department to find him. Jennifer doodled. Finally, the secretary said,
I'm sorry, Mr. Gordon is in a meeting.
I'm calling from Newsline, she said.
Oh,
a pause. Just a minute, please. She smiled. It never failed.
Gordon came on, and she asked him about the JAA certification and the Norton sale to the People's Republic.
Is it true the sale is in jeopardy?
Every airplane sale is in jeopardy until it's concluded, Ms. Malone, Gordon said. But as far as I know, the China sale is in good standing. I did hear a rumor that Norton is having trouble with JAA certification for Europe.
What's the trouble there?
Well, Gordon said, I'm not really an aircraft expert, but the company's had an awful lot of problems.
Norton has problems.
Gordon said, there was that thing in Miami yesterday, and of course you heard about that incident in Dallas.
What's that?
Last year they had an engine flame out on the runway, and everybody jumped off the plane. A bunch of people broke their legs jumping off the wings.
Dallas incident. Engine, broken legs. Tape? Question mark.
She said, uh-huh. I don't know about you, Gordon said, but I don't like to fly very much, and, Jesus Christ, people are jumping off the airplane. That's not a plane I'd want to be on.
She wrote, jumping off plane, yow, unsafe aircraft, and beneath it, in large block letters, she wrote, death trap.
She called Norton Aircraft for their version of the story. She got a PR guy named Benson. He sounded like one of those drawling, half-asleep corporate guys. She decided to hit him right between the eyes.
I want to ask you about the Dallas incident.
Dallas?
His voice sounded startled.
Good.
Last year, she said, you had a flame out of the engine and people jumped off the plane, broke their legs?
Oh, right. That incident involved a 737,
Benson said. Incident with 737? Uh-huh. Well, what can you tell me about it?
Nothing, Benson said. That wasn't our plane.
Oh, come on, she said. Look, I already know about the incident.
That's a Boeing plane.
She sighed.
Jesus, give me a break.
It was so tedious the way these PR types stonewalled, as if a good investigative reporter would never find out the truth. They seemed to think that if they didn't tell her, no one would.
I'm sorry, Ms. Malone, but we don't make that plane.
Well, if that's really true, she said, her tone openly sarcastic, I suppose you can tell me how I can confirm it?
Yes, ma'am, Benson said. You dial area code 206 and ask for Boeing. They'll help you.
Click.
Jesus, what a prick.
How could these companies treat the media this way?
You piss off a reporter, you'll always get paid back.
Didn't they understand that?
She called Boeing, asked for the PR department. She got an answering machine, some bitch reciting a fax number and saying questions should be faxed, and they would get back to her.
Unbelievable, Jennifer thought. A major American corporation, and they didn't even answer the phone.
Irritably, she hung up. There was no point in waiting. If the Dallas incident involved a Boeing plane, she had no story.
No damn story. She drummed her fingers on the desk, trying to decide what to do.
She called Norton back, saying she wanted to talk to someone in management, not PR. She was put through to the president's office, then was transferred to some woman named Singleton.
How can I help you? The woman said. I understand there's been a delay in European certification of the N-22. What's the problem with the plane? Jennifer asked.
No problem at all, Singleton said. We've been flying the N-22 in this country for 5 years.
Well, I've been hearing from sources that this is an unsafe aircraft, Jennifer said. You had an engine flame out on the runway at Miami yesterday.
Actually, we had a rotor burst. That's being investigated now.
The woman was speaking smoothly, calmly, as if it was the most normal thing in the world for an engine to blow up.
Rotor burst.
Uh-huh, Jennifer said.
I see. But if it's true your plane has no problems, why is the JAA withholding certification?
The woman at the other end paused.
I can only give you background on this, she said, off the record.
She sounded unsettled, tense.
Good. Getting somewhere.
There is no problem with the aircraft, Ms. Malone. The issue concerns power plant. In this country, the plane flies with Pratt & Whitney engines, but the JAA is telling us that if we want to sell the plane in Europe, we're going to have to equip it with IAE engines.
IAE?
A European consortium that makes engines, like Airbus. A consortium.
Uh-huh, Jennifer said. IAE equals Consortium Europe.
Now, allegedly, Singleton continued, The JAA wants us to equip the aircraft with IAE engines to meet European noise and emission standards, which are more stringent than those in the U.S. But the reality is we make airframes, not engines, and we believe the engine decision should be left up to the customer. We install the engine the customer asks for. If they want an AIE, we put an AIE on. If they want a Pratt & Whitney, we put Pratt & Whitney on. They want GE, we put GE on. That's the way it's always been in this business. The customer picks the engine, so we consider this an unwarranted regulatory intrusion by the JAA. We're happy to put on IAE engines if Lufthansa or Sabena tells us to do it, but we don't think JAA should dictate the terms of market entry. In other words, the issue has nothing to do with airworthiness. Listening, Jennifer frowned. You're saying it's a regulatory dispute? Exactly. This is a trading bloc issue. The JAA is trying to force us to use European engines, but if that's their goal, we think they should force it on the European airlines, not us.
Regulatory dispute.
And why haven't they forced it on the Europeans? You'd have to ask JAA. But frankly, I imagine they've already tried and been told to go to hell. Aircraft are custom-built to the carrier specs. The operators choose the engines, the electronics packages, the interior configuration. It's their choice. Jennifer was now doodling. She was listening to the tone of the woman's voice at the other end of the line, trying to sense the emotion. This woman sounded slightly bored, like a schoolteacher at the end of the day. Jennifer detected no tension, no hesitation, no hidden secrets. Fuck, she thought. No story. She made one last try. She called the National Transportation Safety Board in Washington. She got put through to a man named Kenner in public affairs. I'm calling about the JAA certification of the N-22. Kenner sounded surprised. Well, you know, that's not really our area. You probably want to talk to someone at the FAA. Can you give me anything on background? Well, FAA aircraft certification is extremely rigorous and has served as the model for foreign regulatory bureaucracies. As long as I can remember, foreign agencies around the world have accepted FAA certification as sufficient. Now the JAA has broken that tradition, and I don't think it's any secret why. It's politics, Ms. Malone. The JAA wants the Americans to use European engines, so they're threatening to withhold certification. And, of course, Norton's about to make a sale of N-22s to China, and Airbus wants that sale.
So the JAA is trashing the plane?
Well, they're certainly raising doubts.
Legitimate doubts?
Not as far as I'm concerned. The N-22's a good plane, a proven plane. Airbus says they have a brand new plane. Norton says they have a proven plane. The Chinese are probably going to take the proven product. It's also somewhat less expensive.
But is the plane safe?
Oh, absolutely.
NTSB says plane is safe.
Jennifer thanked him and hung up. She sat back in her chair and sighed. No story. Nothing. Period. The end.
Shit, she said.
She punched the intercom.
Deborah, she said, about this aircraft thing. Are you watching? Deborah said, squealing.
Watching what?
CNN, it's unfucking believable.
Jennifer grabbed her remote. El Torito Restaurant, 12:05 p.m. The El Torito offered acceptable food at a reasonable price and 52 kinds of beer. It was a local favorite of the engineers. The IRT members were all sitting at a center table in the main room, right off the bar. The waitress had taken their order and was leaving when Kenny Burns said,
So I hear Edgerton's got a few problems.
Don't we all, Doug Daugherty said, reaching for the chips and salsa.
Martyr hates him.
So what,
Ron Smith said. Martyr hates everybody.
Yeah, but the thing is,
Kenny said, I keep hearing Martyr's not gonna...
Oh, Jesus, look!
Doug Daugherty pointed across the room toward the bar. They all turned to stare at the television set mounted above the bar. The sound was down, but the image was unmistakable. The interior of a Norton wide-body jet, as seen by a badly shaking video camera. Passengers were literally flying through the air, bouncing off luggage racks and wall panels, tumbling over the seats. "Holy shit," Kenny said. They got up from the table, ran into the bar, shouting, "Sound! Turn up the sound!" The horrifying images continued. By the time Casey got into the bar, the video segment had ended. The television now showed a thin man with a mustache wearing a carefully cut blue suit, which somehow suggested a uniform. She recognized Bradley King, an attorney who specialized in airline accidents.
"Well, that figures," Byrne said. "It's Sky King." "I think this footage speaks for itself," Bradley King was saying. "My client, Mr. Song, provided it to us, and it vividly portrays the terrible ordeal passengers were subjected to on this doomed flight. This aircraft went into an unprovoked and uncontrolled dive. It came within 500 feet of crashing in the Pacific Ocean."
"What?" Kenny Byrne said. "It did what?"
"As you know, I'm a pilot myself, and I can say with absolute conviction that what occurred is a result of well-known design flaws on the N-22 jet. Norton has known about these design flaws for years and has done nothing. Pilots, operators, and FAA specialists have all complained bitterly about the aircraft. I personally know pilots who refuse to fly the N-22 because it's so unsafe."
"Especially the ones on your payroll," Byrne said. On the television, King was saying,
"Yet the Norton Aircraft Company has done nothing substantive to address these safety concerns. It's inexplicable, really, that they could know about these problems and do nothing. Given their criminal negligence, it was only a matter of time until a tragedy like this occurred. Now 3 people are dead, 2 passengers paralyzed, the co-pilot in a coma as we speak. Altogether, 57 passengers required hospitalization. That's a disgrace to aviation."
"That sleazebag," Kenny Byrne said. "He knows it's not true." But the television was showing the CNN tape again, this time in slow motion, the bodies spiraling through the air, alternately blurred and sharp. Watching it, Casey started to sweat. She felt dizzy and cold, her chest tight. The restaurant around her became dim, pale green. She dropped quickly to a bar stool, took a deep breath. Now the television showed a bearded man with a scholarly air, standing near one of the runways at LAX. Aircraft were taxiing in the background. She couldn't hear what the man was saying because the engineers around her were screaming at the image.
"You asshole, fuckface, weenie prick,
lying dipshit. Will you guys shut up?" she said. The bearded man on the screen was Frederick Barker, a former FAA official, no longer with the agency. Barker had testified in court against the company several times in recent years. The engineers all hated him. Barker was saying,
"Oh, yes, I'm afraid there's no question about the problem."
About what problem, she thought, but now the television cut back to the CNN studio in Atlanta, the female anchor in front of a photograph of the N-22. Beneath the photograph it said, "Unsafe?" In huge red letters.
"Christ, do you believe that shit?" Kenny Byrne said. "Sky King and then that scumbag Barker. Don't they know Barker works for King?"
The television now showed a bombed-out building in the Middle East. Casey turned away, got off the bar stool, took a deep breath.
"God damn, I want a beer," Kenny Byrne said.
He headed back to the table. The others followed him, muttering about Fred Barker. Casey picked up her purse, got her cell phone out, and called the office.
"Norma," she said,
"call CNN and get a copy of the tape they just ran on the N-22.
"I was just going out to..."
"Now," Casey said. "Do it right now." Newsline, 3:06 p.m.
"Deborah?"
Jennifer screamed, watching the tape.
"Call CNN and get a copy of that Norton tape."
Jennifer watched, transfixed. Now they were running it again, this time in slow motion, 6 frames a second, and it held up. Fantastic. She saw one poor bastard tumble through the air like a diver out of control, arms and legs flailing in all directions. The guy smashed into a seat, and his neck snapped.
the body twisting, before he bounced up in the air again and hit the ceiling. Incredible. His neck being broken right on tape. It was the greatest piece of tape she'd ever seen. And the sound, fabulous. People screaming in pure terror, sounds you couldn't fake. People shouting in Chinese, which made it very exotic. And all these incredible crashing noises as people and bags and shit smashed into the walls and ceilings. Jesus. It was fabulous tape. Unbelievable. And it went on for an eternity. 45 seconds, and all of it good. Because even when the camera wobbled, when it streaked and blurred, that just added to it. You couldn't pay a cameraman to do that. Deborah, she screamed. Deborah! She was so excited her heart was pounding. She felt like she was going to jump out of her skin. She was dimly aware of the guy on camera now, some weasel lawyer feeding the segment his opening arguments. It must be his tape. But she knew he would give it to Newsline. He'd want the exposure, which meant they had a story. Fantastic. Little frill and build, and they were there. Deborah came in, flushed, excited. Jennifer said, "Get me the clips on the Norton aircraft for the last 5 years. Do a nexus search on the N-22 on a guy named Bradley King and a guy named..." She looked back at the screen. "Frederick Barker. Download it all. I want it. Now." 20 minutes later, she had the outlines of the story and the background on the key figures. L.A. Times story from 5 years ago on the rollout, certification, and maiden flight for the launch customer of the Norton N-22. Advanced avionics, advanced electronic control systems, and autopilot, blah, blah, blah. The New York Times story on Bradley King, the controversial plaintiff's attorney, under fire for approaching the families of crash victims before they had been officially informed of their relative's death by the airlines. Another L.A. Times story on Bradley King settling a class action suit after the Atlanta crash. Long Beach Independent Press telegram, "Bradley King, the king of aviation torts, censured by the Ohio Bar for misconduct in contacting victims' families. King denies wrongdoing." New York Times story, "Has Bradley King gone too far?" L.A. Times story on whistleblower Frederick Barker's controversial departure from the FAA. Barker, an outspoken critic, says he quit in dispute over the N-22. Supervisor says Barker was fired for leaking reports to media. Barker sets up private practice as aviation consultant. Long Beach Independent Press telegram. Fred Barker launches crusade against Norton N-22, which he claims as a history of unacceptable safety incidents. Orange County Telegraph star, Fred Barker's campaign to make airlines safe. Orange County Telegraph star, Barker accuses FAA of failing to clamp down on unsafe Norton aircraft. Orange County Telegraph star, Barker key witness for Bradley King lawsuit settled out of court. Jennifer was beginning to see the shape that the story would take. Clearly, they should stay away from the ambulance chaser Bradley King, but Barker, a former FAA official, would be useful. He would probably also be able to criticize certification practices by the FAA. And she noticed that Jack Rogers, the reporter for the Orange County Telegraph Star, took a particularly critical view of Norton aircraft. She noted several recent stories under Rogers' byline, "Orange County Telegraph star Edgerton under pressure to make new sales for troubled company. Dissension among directors, top management, doubts he will succeed. Orange County Telegraph star, drug and gang activity on Norton twin jet assembly line. Orange County Telegraph star, rumors of union trouble. Workers oppose the China sale, which they say will ruin the company." Jennifer smiled. Things were definitely looking up. She called Jack Rogers at his newspaper. "I've been reading your pieces on Norton. They're excellent. I gather you think the company's got some problems?"
"A lot of problems," Rogers said.
"You mean with the airplanes?"
"Well, yes, but they're also having union problems."
"What's that about?"
"It's not clear, but the plant's in turmoil and management's not leading. The union's angry about the China sale, thinks it shouldn't happen."
Will you talk about this on camera?
Sure, I can't give you my sources, but I'll tell you what I know.
Of course he would, Jennifer thought. It was the dream of every print reporter to somehow get on television. The print guys all understood the real money came from appearing on the box. No matter how successful you were in print, you were nothing unless you could get on TV. Once you had name recognition from TV, you could migrate to the lucrative lecture circuit, getting $5,000-$10,000 just to speak at a lunch.
I'll probably be out later in the week. My office will contact you.
Just tell me when, Rogers said.
She called Fred Barker in Los Angeles. He almost seemed to be expecting her call.
That's pretty dramatic videotape, she said.
It's frightening, Barker said, when an aircraft slats deploy at nearly the speed of sound. That's what happened on the Trans-Pacific flight. It's the 9th such incident since the aircraft entered service.
The 9th?
Oh, yes, this is nothing new, Ms. Malone. At least 3 other deaths are attributable to Norton's shoddy design, and yet the company has done nothing.
You have a list?
Give me your fax number.
She stared at the list.
It was a little too detailed for her taste, but still compelling.
Norton N-22 Slats Deployment Incidents. 1. January 4, 1992. Slats deployed at FL-350 at 0.84 Mach. The flap slat handle moved inadvertently. 2. April 2, 1992. Slats deployed while the airplane was in cruise at 0.81 Mach. A clipboard reportedly fell on the flap slat handle. 3. July 17, 1992. Initially reported as severe turbulence. However, it was later learned that the slats had extended as a result of inadvertent flap slat handle movement. 5 passenger injuries, 3 serious. 4. December 20, 1992. Slats extended in cruise flight without movement of the flap slat handle in cockpit. 2 passenger injuries. 5. March 12, 1993. Airplane entered a pre-stall buffet at 0.82 Mach. The slats were found to be extended, and the handle was not in the up-unlocked position. 6. April 4, 1993. First officer rested his arm on the flap slat handle, moved the handle down, extending the slats. Several passenger injuries. 7. July 4, 1993. Pilot reported the flap slat handle moved and slats extended. Aircraft was in cruise flight at 0.81 Mach. 8. June 10, 1994. The slats extended while the plane was in cruise flight without movement of the flap slat handle. She picked up the phone and called Barker back. Will you talk about these incidents on camera? I've testified in court about this on numerous occasions, Barker said. I'll be happy to speak to you on the record. The fact is, I want this airplane fixed before more people die. And nobody has been willing to do it, not the company and not the FAA. It's a disgrace.
But how can you be so sure this flight was a slats accident?
I have a source inside Norton, Barker said. A disgruntled employee who's tired of all the lying. My source tells me it is slats, and the company is covering up.
Jennifer got off the phone with Barker and pushed the intercom button.
Deborah, she screamed, get me travel.
Jennifer closed the door to her office and sat quietly. She knew she had a story. A fabulous story. The question now was, what's the angle? How do you frame it? On a show like Newsline, the frame was all important. Older producers on the show talked about context, which to them meant putting the story in a larger setting, indicating what the story meant by reporting what had happened before or reporting similar things that had occurred. The older guys thought context so important, they seemed to regard it as a kind of moral or ethical obligation. Jennifer disagreed. Because when you cut out all the sanctimonious bullshit, context was just spin, a way of pumping the story, and not a very useful way because context meant referring to the past. Jennifer had no interest in the past. She was one of the new generation that understood that gripping television was now, events happening now, a flow of images in a perpetual, unending electronic present. Context, by its very nature, required something more than now, and her interest did not go beyond now. Nor, she thought, did anyone else's. The past was dead and gone. Who cared what you ate yesterday, what you did yesterday? What was immediate and compelling was now. And television at its best was now. So a good frame had nothing to do with the past. Fred Barker's damning list of prior incidents was actually a problem because it drew attention to the fading, boring past. She'd have to find a way around it, give it a mention, and go on. What she was looking for was a way to shape the story so that it unfolded now, in a pattern that the viewer could follow. The best frames engaged the viewer by presenting the story as conflict between good and bad, a morality story, because the audience got that. If you framed a story that way, you got instant acceptance. You were speaking their language. But because the story also had to unfold quickly, this morality tale had to hang from a series of hooks that did not need to be explained. Things the audience already knew to be true. They already knew big corporations were corrupt, their leaders greedy sexist pigs. You didn't have to prove that, you just had to mention it. They already knew that government bureaucracies were inept and lazy. You didn't have to prove that, either. And they already knew that products were cynically manufactured, with no concern for consumer safety. From such agreed-upon elements, she must construct her morality story. A fast-moving morality story happening now. Of course, there was still another requirement for the frame. Before anything else, she must sell the segment to Dick Schenck. She had to come up with an angle that would appeal to Schenck, that would fit his view of the world. And that was no easy matter. Schenck was more sophisticated than the audience, more difficult to please. Within the newsline offices, Schenck was known as the critic, for the harsh way he shot down proposed segments. Walking around the office, Schenck adopted an affable air, playing the grand old man. But all that changed when he listened to a proposal. Then he became dangerous. Dick Schenck was well-educated and smart, very smart. And he could be charming when he wanted to, but at bottom, he was mean. He had grown meaner with age, cultivating his nasty streak, regarding it as a key to his success. Now she was going to take a proposal into him. She knew Schenck would want a story badly. But he would also be angry about Pacino, angry about Marty, and his anger could quickly turn against Jennifer and her proposed segment. To avoid his anger, to sell him this segment, she would have to proceed carefully. She would have to fashion the story into a shape that, more than anything else, gave vent to Dick Schenck's hostility and anger and turned it in a useful direction. She reached for a notepad and began to sketch the outlines of what she would say. Administration, 1:04 p.m. Casey got into the elevator in administration, Richmond following her.
I don't understand, he said. Why is everybody so angry with King?
Because he's lying, Casey said. He knows the aircraft didn't come within 500 feet of the Pacific Ocean. Everybody'd be dead if it did. The incident happened at 37,000 feet. At most, the aircraft dropped 3,000 or 4,000 feet. That's bad enough.
So? He's getting attention, making the case for his client. He knows what he's doing.
Yes, he does.
Hasn't Norton settled out of court with him in the past?
3 times, she said.
Richmond shrugged. If you have a strong case, take him to trial.
Yes, Casey said. But trials are very expensive, and the publicity doesn't do us any good. It's cheaper to settle and just add the cost of his green mail to the price of our aircraft. The carriers pay that price and pass it on to the customer. So in the end, every airline passenger pays a few dollars extra for their ticket in a hidden tax. The litigation tax. The Bradley King tax. That's how it works in the real world. The doors opened and they came out on the 4th floor. She hurried down the corridor toward her department.
Where are we going now? Richmond said.
To get something important that I forgot all about. She looked at him.
And you did, too.
Newsline, 4:45 p.m. Jennifer Malone headed toward Dick Shank's office. On the way, she passed his wall of fame, a tight arrangement of photographs, plaques, and awards. The photographs showed intimate moments with the rich and famous. Shank riding horses with Reagan. Shank on a yacht with Cronkite. Shank in a Southampton softball game with Tisch. Shank with Clinton, Shank with Ben Bradley. And in the far corner, a photograph of an absurdly young Shank with shoulder-length hair, an Aeroflex mounted on his shoulder, filming John Kennedy in the Oval Office. Dick Shank had begun his career in the 60s as a scrappy documentary producer back in the days when the news divisions were prestige loss leaders for the networks, autonomous, handsomely budgeted, lavishly staffed. Those were the great days of the CBS White Papers and NBC Reports. Back then, when Shank was a kid running around with an Airy, he was in the world getting real stuff that mattered. With age and success, Shank's horizons had narrowed. His world was now limited to his weekend house in Connecticut and his brownstone in New York. If he went anywhere else, it was in a limousine. But despite his privileged upbringing, his Yale education, his beautiful ex-wives, his comfortable existence, and his worldly success, Shank, at 60, was dissatisfied with his life. Riding around in his limousine, he felt unappreciated, not enough recognition, not enough respect for his accomplishments. The questing kid with the camera had aged into a querulous and bitter adult. Feeling he had been denied respect himself, Shank in turn denied it to others, adopting a pervasive cynicism toward everything around him. And that was why she felt certain he would buy her frame on the Norton story. Jennifer entered the outer office, stopped by Marianne's desk. "Gonna see Dick?" Marianne said. "Is he in?" She nodded. "You want company?"
"Do I need it?" Jennifer said, raising an eyebrow. "Well," Marianne said, "he's been drinking."
"It's okay," Jennifer said. "I can handle him."
Dick Shank listened to her, eyes closed, fingers pressed together to make a steeple. From time to time, he nodded slightly as she spoke. She ran through the proposed segment, hitting all the beats. The Miami incident, the JAA certification story, the Trans-Pacific flight, the jeopardized China sale, the former FAA expert who says the plane has a long history of uncorrected design problems, the aviation reporter who says the company is mismanaged, drugs and gang activity on the factory floor, a controversial new president trying to boost flagging sales, portrait of a once proud company in trouble. The way to frame the piece, she said, was rot beneath the surface. She laid it out. Badly run company makes a shoddy product for years. Knowledgeable people complain, but the company never responds. FAA is in bed with the company and won't force the issue. Now, at last, the truth comes out. The Europeans balk at certification. The Chinese have cold feet. The plane continues to kill passengers, just as critics said it would. And there's tape, riveting tape, showing the agonies passengers went through as several died. At the close, it's obvious to all, the N-22 is a death trap. She finished. There was a long moment of silence. Then Shank opened his eyes.
"Not bad," he said.
She smiled.
"What's the company's response?" he asked in a lazy voice.
"Stonewall, the plane's safe, the critics are lying."
"Just what you'd expect,"
Shank said, shaking his head.
"American stuff is so shitty."
Dick drove a BMW. His tastes ran to Swiss watches, French wines, English shoes.
"Everything this country makes is crap," he said.
He slumped back in his chair as if fatigued by the thought. Then his voice became lazy again, thoughtful.
"But what can they offer as proof?"
"Not much," Jennifer said. "The Miami and Trans-Pacific incidents are still under investigation."
"Reports due when?"
"Not for weeks."
"Ah."
He nodded slowly.
I like it. I like it very much. It's compelling journalism, and it beats the shit out of 60 Minutes. They did unsafe airplane parts last month, but we're talking about a whole unsafe aircraft, a death trap. Perfect. Scare the hell out of everybody.
I think so, too, she said. She was smiling broadly now. He had bought it.
And I'd love to stick it to Hewitt, Dick said.
Don Hewitt, the legendary producer of 60 Minutes, was Shank's nemesis. Hewitt consistently got better press than Shank, which rankled.
Those jerk-offs, he said. Remember when they did their hard-hitting segment on off-season golf pros?
She shook her head. Actually, no.
It was a while back, Dick said.
He got fuzzy for a moment, staring into space, and it was clear to her that he had been drinking heavily at lunch.
Never mind. Okay, where are we? You got the FAA guy, you got the reporter, you got tape of Miami. The peg is the home video. We lead with that.
Right, she said, nodding.
But CNN is going to run it day and night, he said. By next week, it'll be ancient history. We've got to go with the story Saturday.
Right, she said.
You got 12 minutes, he said.
He spun in his chair, looked at the colored strips on the wall, representing the segments in production where the talent was going to be.
And you got a... Marty. He's doing Bill Gates in Seattle on Thursday. We'll shuttle him to L.A. Friday. You'll have him 6-7 hours.
Okay.
He spun back. Go do it.
Okay, she said. Thanks, Dick.
You sure you can put it together in time?
She started collecting her notes. Trust me. As she headed out through Marion's office, she heard him shout,
Just remember, Jennifer, don't come back with a part story. I don't want a fucking part story.
Q.A. Norton, 2:21 p.m. Casey came into the QA office with Richmond. Norma was back from lunch, lighting another cigarette.
Norma, she said, have you seen a videotape around here, one of those little 8mm things?
Yeah, Norma said. You left it on your desk the other night. I put it away.
She rummaged in her drawer, brought it out. She turned to Richmond.
And you got 2 calls from Martyr. He wants you to call him right away.
Okay,
Richmond said. He walked down the hall to his office. When he was gone, Norma said,
You know, he talks to Martyr a lot. I heard it from Eileen.
Martyr's getting in with the Norton relatives?
Norma was shaking her head. He's already married Charlie's only daughter, for Christ's sake.
What are you saying? Casey said. Richmond's reporting to Martyr?
About 3 times a day.
Casey frowned. Why?
Good question, honey. I think you're being set up.
For what?
I have no idea, Norma said.
Something about the China sale?
Norma shrugged.
I don't know, but Martyr is the best corporate infighter in the history of the company, and he's good at covering his tracks. I'd be real careful around this kid.
She leaned across her desk, lowered her voice.
When I got back from lunch, she said, nobody was around. The kid keeps his briefcase in his office. So I had a look.
And? Richmond's copying everything in sight. He's got a copy of every memo on your desk, and he's Xeroxed your phone logs.